Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Electra Naismith, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 2nd of July, these are our main stories. Hong Kong's chief executive condemns protesters who took control of the territory's Legislative Council building. European foreign ministers call on Iran to reverse its decision to breach an international nuclear deal. Fresh concerns have been raised about the rate of deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon. Also in this podcast...
The stigma of false allegations sticks, and something needs to be done to readdress the balance.
The veteran pop star Cliff Richard joins the fight to protect those accused of sexual misconduct before they're charged. Police in Hong Kong have regained control of the Parliament building after protesters broke into the main debate chamber and occupied it for several hours on Monday, spraying messages on the walls such as "Hong Kong is not China." Thousands of demonstrators took to the streets frustrated by what they say is the Hong Kong government's lack of response to their demands.
Government leave us no choice. They never respond to us. Our four requests, they never respond to us. And we have nothing to do but to fight. We have to fight as more as we can, and therefore the government will listen to us.
At 4 a.m. local time, Hong Kong's chief executive Carrie Lam held a news conference, once again condemning the violence used by some demonstrators.
This is something that we should seriously condemn, because nothing is more important than the rule of law in Hong Kong. So I hope the community at large will agree with us that with these violent acts that we have seen, it is right for us to condemn it and hope society will return to normal.
Our correspondent Nick Beek spent the day at the Legislative Council building and spoke to me shortly after the protesters were evicted.
I'm actually in the chamber, so the place where normally the politicians have their say, they debate the future of this city, shape the direction of travel. But if I try and describe this incredible scene in front of me, this is the place where we saw some of the most extraordinary images today, because this is the place that the protesters took over. So in front of me, you can see bottles of water, food, you've got tape, scissors, gloves. If we just look down here, I can see that some people have left takeaway food. There are buns, there are biscuits. It's extraordinary that this place where decisions are made has been completely overrun by protesters who are able to smash their way through the door, come up the escalators and occupy this place. And I'm just looking to the main part of the chamber where all normally the cameras would be focused on as the politicians had their say. And the emblem of Hong Kong tonight has been graffitied over. And the portraits of those who've been in power over the last few decades, they've been defaced, and I think they're pretty striking images this evening.
The protests themselves were initially against the extradition law, which has now been suspended, but they seem to be far bigger. What is it that people are asking for?
You're absolutely right. I mean, ostensibly, the main protest today was against this bill that no one here apparently wanted, the fact that suspects could be sent to mainland China to face trial. That was really the focus of initial anger, but this has mushroomed into a much wider protest movement, and there's a real anti-Beijing sentiment that pulses through it. People talking about their future. They want a future which is more democratic. They don't want the powers that be in China to dictate how the next few decades pan out. And so, yeah, it's really difficult to see what happens now, because although you've got the specific issue that people have been angry about, people are talking about more democracy. One man I spoke to today, he said, this is a revolution. We're not going away. How do the authorities respond to this?
Nick Beek in Hong Kong. The BBC's Julian Marshall spoke to Hong Kong Democratic legislator Claudia Mo. What did she make of the scenes in the city on Monday?
They are shocking. They are very unexpected. But then I and many Hong Kong people would understand the young's frustration and the really pent-up anger against the government. And in particular, they are very upset at the legislature, which has been just a rubber-stamping body all these years. It's a rubber-stamping body because the Beijing functionaries outnumbered the Democrats, myself included, all because of this very twisted election system in Hong Kong. And in the last election, we actually won fairly handsomely, although we still didn't manage to get the half mark out of 70. But then still, they would twist laws and rules and what have you to kick out altogether six of our elected democratic lawmakers. How about that? And the young could say it. They've been very angry over this. And this China extradition bill is a huge trigger because it would mean putting Hong Kong under Chinese law. And that's what we've been going against.
But can their anger really justify the ransacking of the territory's parliament, daubing graffiti on the walls, destroying pictures? Can that really be justified in your view?
That's a very sorry sight, I agree. I mean, vandalism cannot be endorsed. And as a matter of fact, the young, when caught, could be facing all kinds of charges. I don't know, illegal assembly, criminal damage. But then they have adopted this, we have nothing to lose approach. I did talk to a couple of young apparent leaders of the young earlier in the day. And they were telling me the government has pushed them to this point. They're on this cliff. They're falling. And they have to do what they have to do. And they did it. That's what you saw now. It's very sorrowful. It's heartbreaking. But then, in a way, they probably fell into a trap because there was no police around altogether. The young stormed into this legislative building, which was completely unguarded. They started vandalizing it. And maybe that's the idea.
You're suggesting that they were lured into a trap by the authorities?
In a way, I don't know if it's a fair kind of speculation, but I'm not the only one thinking that. Because all those sorrowful pictures now you can see around the world would somehow blame them, blame on the young, that, look at all these ruffians, this rioters, this completely unruly young people in Hong Kong, they're completely mad, and so on and so forth. We knew the anger could put to something, but I wasn't expecting the extent of damage. It was going to be like this. I call for calm.
Julian Marshall speaking with Hong Kong Democratic legislator Claudia Moe. European foreign ministers have called on Iran to reverse its decision to violate the terms of the 2015 nuclear deal by breaching the agreed limit on how much enriched uranium it can hold. The United Nations has also urged Iran to return to the terms of the deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. The UN Secretary General's spokesman is Stefan Dujarric.
If verified, such action by the Islamic Republic of Iran would not help preserve the plan nor secure the tangible economic benefits for the Iranian people. He encourages the Islamic Republic of Iran to continue implementing all its nuclear-related commitments under the JCPOA as the participants continue to seek ways to overcome the considerable challenges the country faces.
Well, speaking at a NATO meeting in Brussels, the acting U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper insisted that Washington had no desire for war.
Our goal is to bring Iran to the negotiating table to conclude a comprehensive, enduring deal that addresses Iran's nuclear program, its ballistic missile development and proliferation, its support for terrorism, and other malign activities. Our strategy is, at its core, an economic and diplomatic one. Again, we do not seek armed conflict with Iran, but we are ready to defend U.S. forces and interests in the region.
Our World Affairs correspondent Paul Adams assesses the significance of Iran's move.
After 4 years of strict adherence to the agreement's numerous provisions, Iran has, for the first time, broken the rules. Under the terms of the deal, Iran was allowed to stockpile up to 300 kilograms of low-enriched uranium, a fraction of what it had before. Exceeding that limit is a modest and reversible step. But Iran has already threatened more, saying that from next week it'll start enriching uranium to higher levels of concentration, reducing the time it would take to build a bomb. Iran says it's within its rights. It was the Trump administration that acted first, pulling out of the deal and imposing a new round of crippling sanctions. But today's move puts the deal's European backers, Britain, France and Germany, in a tough spot.
Paul Adams. An area of Amazon rainforest, roughly the size of a football pitch, is now being cleared every single minute. The rate of loss has accelerated as Brazil's new right-wing president, Jair Bolsonaro, favours development over conservation. The Amazon is the largest rainforest in the world and is a vital store of carbon, slowing the pace of global warming. More from our science editor, David Shukman.
Dawn in the largest rainforest in the world. Billions of trees storing so much carbon they help to slow down global warming. They're also home to countless forms of wildlife. But more and more of the forest is being destroyed. I'm walking between massive trees lying on their sides, the area quiet and barren. To bring these trees down to the ground, they just knock them over with a bulldozer. This is happening all over the Amazon to create new farmland. And the result is that the great forest has never been under such pressure. The election of the right-wing Jair Bolsonaro as Brazil's new president has changed everything for the Amazon. His supporters love his talk of exploiting the region. And he's banned his environment officials from speaking in public. But one of them agreed to talk to us. To protect his identity, his words are spoken by somebody else.
They don't want us to speak because we'll say the truth, that conservation units are being invaded and destroyed. There are many people marking out areas that should be protected. And deforestation figures are surging and could be even bigger than we think.
Deforestation has reached a staggering scale. An area the size of a football pitch is cleared every single minute. Recent Brazilian governments were quite successful at curbing the losses, but this one is very different. It's attacked the system of fines for illegal logging and wants to weaken the laws conserving the region. The president's rhetoric, says the environment official, has emboldened people who want to use the forest.
They just don't feel completely liberated because there's the judiciary, the laws and established procedures that don't give them all that freedom. But they feel more encouraged to invade these areas because they have political support. And when you send the message that the environment oversight body is bad, an enemy of the people, you can more easily work on changing laws or on cancelling the creation of conservation units, counting on people's support instead of strengthening the environment agencies.
On a highway cut through the forest, trucks carry soya beans to a port. Industrial-scale agriculture has already reached the Amazon. The president wants more of it. And farmers like Vandelei Wegner believe that's right. And they say other countries have chopped their forests down already.
We have to develop the Amazon. More than 4 million people live here, and they need development too. It's a constitutional right of every Brazilian citizen.
The government here says only Brazil can decide what to do with the forest. But the trees are one of the few things limiting the rise in global temperatures. So the world is watching.
David Shukman with that report. And we did ask to speak to two government ministers about the push to weaken environmental laws, but they declined to speak to us. Over the past 2 years, allegations of sexual assault and harassment have been given more attention and been treated more seriously than ever before. But the Me Too movement, as it's known, has also sparked debate about the risk of false accusations and the rights of those accused. Here in the UK, thousands of people have signed a petition calling for laws that would protect the anonymity of the accused until they're charged by police. A handful of celebrities have championed the petition, including the veteran British pop singer Sir Cliff Richard. Our legal correspondent Clive Coleman reports.
In 2014, police raided Sir Cliff Richard's home as part of an investigation into an allegation of historical sexual assault. The BBC was tipped off, named Sir Cliff, and filmed the raid using a helicopter. Sir Cliff was never charged or even arrested and successfully sued the BBC for breach of his privacy. Speaking of his ordeal, Sir Cliff said he'd developed shingles over his face and head, couldn't sleep properly for 4 years, and felt his reputation was in tatters. He explained his reasons for backing anonymity for those suspected of sexual offences unless and until they're charged.
Our aim is to start the process of rebalancing the criminal justice system in relation to sexual allegations.
the stigma of false allegations sticks, and something needs to be done to readdress the balance. Except, of course, in truly exceptional circumstances, because if someone is a known serial rapist or a murderer and they're running free, you have to be warned to stay away.
The petition's backed by, among others, Stephen Fry, the former BBC chairman Lord Grade, and the DJ Paul Gambaccini, who was arrested over a claim of historical sexual abuse and placed on bail for a year before the case was dropped. But many opposed the change, fearing it would damage the confidence of genuine victims to come forward. And the Labour MP Harriet Harman thinks the answer lies with the police.
Paul Gambaccini and Cliff Richard should be arguing for the rules to be enforced as they are now. And their complaint should be not that the legislation's wrong, but that chief officers of police are not stopping police officers giving out information which can be premature and very damaging to reputations.
The petition needs 100,000 signatures to be considered for a debate in Parliament. One day in, it already has over 10,000.
Clive Coleman. Still to come in this podcast.
This is a place where history was made. The books were written. The challenges were issued. They were controlled. We moved forward. Accepted risk is the price of progress.
The Eagle has landed again. The Johnson Space Centre opens once more after years of neglect. In West Africa, genetically modified mosquitoes have been released in Burkina Faso as part of an anti-malaria campaign. While some critics have raised concerns, the scientists behind the move say the release, the first of its kind in Africa, represents an important milestone. Our correspondent Louise de Wast reports.
Burkina Faso's Research Institute of Health Sciences, a government-sponsored institution, has released male genetically modified mosquitoes in the southwestern town of Bana. It's part of a project funded by Target Malaria, a research consortium led by Imperial College London. While the release was approved by the country's National Biosafety Agency, critics have raised concerns about the risks involved and questioned the validity of the project, saying it is not expected to deliver any benefits for malaria control. Target Malaria says the release itself is not intended to reduce the incidence of malaria, but says it will enable them to collect important data to inform their research. The institution says the mosquito release conformed to all ethical and regulatory requirements and that it was approved by the community during consultations. Malaria killed more than 4,000 people in Burkina Faso last year and affected more than 12,000.
Louise de Wast. 11 years after Kosovo unilaterally declared its independence from Serbia, the two countries coexist uneasily, to say the least. Their leaders were due to meet in Paris on Monday to try to find a long-term resolution of their differences, but the summit has been scrapped. Kosovo's imposition of a 100% tariff on Serbian imports is part of the reason. The US and the EU have urged the government in Kosovo to drop the tax, but there's no sign of them relenting. Our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaney reports from the Kosovan capital, Pristina.
Here at Mitched Pub in the centre of Pristina, it's hard to tell that a rather one-sided trade war has been raging for months. The beer and burgers are flowing as freely as usual. But this place and its customers have felt the effects of the 100% tariff that Kosovo imposed on Serbian imports last November. The pub's owner, Alban Ibrahimi, says that ordinary people are paying the price for the dispute between Pristina and Belgrade.
Just yesterday, for example, I was going around the supermarket and I saw all of these products from Serbia again being imported as they used to be. The only difference is the price. So the local customer is the one that gets all the burden from all of these tariffs. Everybody with a common sense knows that the tariffs should go.
The 20th anniversary of the arrival of NATO peacekeepers brought a strong show of support from Kosovo's friends in Western Europe and the United States.
20 years later, I think you have done a fine job of winning the peace.
But they've been putting pressure on Pristina to lift the tariff and restart normalization talks with Belgrade.
Riccardo Seri is the head of the European Integration Section at the EU mission in Kosovo. He says Pristina's risking its relationships by maintaining the tariffs.
Well, in its relations with the EU, it has been quite a problem. They believe that Kosovo is being mistreated by Serbia, preventing Kosovo, for example, to become members of international organization. Interpol was the latest example, following which Kosovo, the government, decided to introduce those tariffs.
What can the EU counsel Kosovo to do now?
Well, as I said, the position that Kosovo should take at this stage in order for the dialogue to start again is to leave the tariffs. Serbia will not engage in a dialogue as long as the tariffs are there.
But Kosovo's prime minister has been resolute in his refusal to budge. Ramush Haradinaj told me there's only one solution as far as he's concerned.
The way out of where we are, it's a comprehensive agreement on recognition between Serbia and Kosovo. Yes, we are ready to stand for ourselves forever. We have no choice, no alternative.
And that's despite any pressure from Washington or Brussels or the individual member states?
We respect this pressure. We welcome it. However, where is the solution?
So there's no sign of prices going down at the tills or talks with Belgrade restarting. That's bad news for consumers and anyone interested in stability in the Western Balkans.
Guy Delaney reporting from Pristina. Now to the Horn of Africa and a remarkable story of survival against the odds. The authorities in Eritrea say a rare species of gazelle that had been thought to have been lost forever has been rediscovered. Our Africa regional editor Mary Harper told me more.
The wildlife authorities in Eritrea are saying that this gazelle, which is known as the Eritrean gazelle, hasn't been seen for more than 100 years. It hasn't been seen since the time of the Italian colonisation of Eritrea. And it's also exciting news for conservationists because it is classed as an endangered species.
So how do you lose a species of animal for 100 years?
Eritrea has been affected by war for years and years and years, so it's possible that the gazelle fled or became very, very small in number. And that's what the authorities are saying. They're also blaming the colonial power for its disappearance, but also saying that the years of war that Eritrea has been involved with could have had an effect on the gazelle.
Now, apparently the Eritrean gazelle can survive for a year without water. That can't be true, surely.
Well, that's what they're saying. That's what the wildlife authorities are saying in Eritrea. But it seems that what it does is that it eats leaves and berries that have moisture in them, and that's how it manages to survive. And it is the case that Eritrea is an incredibly arid, dry, harsh environment, very rocky, very sandy, very stony. So you do wonder how a gazelle can survive in that kind of environment anyway. So it must be a very hardy breed of gazelle.
And what does it look like?
It's quite small. It looks quite similar. There's a gazelle called the Thompson's gazelle in Kenya. It's very well known. It looks a bit like a Thompson's gazelle, but it has this very distinctive black mark along the side of its tummy, and that's what identifies it as the Eritrean gazelle.
Mary Harper reporting there. Now, 50 years after Neil Armstrong became the first man to set foot on the moon, NASA has restored its original Apollo mission control room at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. The painstaking renovation cost $5 million, took years of fundraising and 7 months of restoration work. It officially opened on Monday. Richard Hamilton compiled this report.
We copy it down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
On the 20th of July 1969, Apollo 11 touched down on the lunar surface, guided by Mission Control in Houston. But the famous control room fell into disrepair after NASA moved its team to a more modern facility in 1992. What's remarkable about this newly restored centre is the attention to detail. It's been fitted with either original or replica accessories based on archive photos. These include the carpets, coat racks, coffee machines, pens, and even ashtrays, but without the cigarette smoke.
3, 2, 1, liftoff! Hey!
The remodeled centre was opened by Gene Kranz, who is the flight director for Apollo 11 at the Johnson Space Centre.
This is a place where history was made. The books were written. The challenges were issued. They were controlled. We moved forward. We accepted risk as the price of progress. At times, we went too far too fast. We lost a crew, but we picked the ball up and continued to run forward even stronger.
Spurred on by an additional increase to NASA's budget by President Trump, the agency is planning to mark another chapter in the history of space exploration by sending the first woman to the moon by 2024.
Richard Hamilton reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Electra Naismith. Until next time, goodbye.